wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hello. Wait, hold on. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. We're it joined works. Here with, we've got Alan here. How are you today?
Oh, I'm just contemplating next week, basically.
Next week?
All the
what
students
for?
Come back next
oh,
week.
Oh, yo.
We start a week earlier than you guys,
yeah, I'm seeing
apparently.
All these people holding the orientation signs out on Simon Street.
Yes, yes. So we're getting the jump on you. Yes.
Getting ahead of it. anyway, yeah. Well, maybe... for some of those students who are listening in, we've got some really cool topics that we can share with them today.
There
so
we go.
To give them the jump on their degrees, their science degrees. Or yeah, maybe this is like a lesson in anyway.
I don't know where you were going segue. With that one, Sarah.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, I tried. This is an educational segment. We've got some really cool pieces to talk about today. So this first one we'll start with is solar energy. There's actually a very I was very glad that you brought this one because this is such a cool question to think about the like how solar energy can be used or yeah like used when the sun is away or like when it's cloudy or rainy or when it's nighttime.
Yep, yep.
And there's some research about this. So did you want to talk about this one a little bit?
Absolutely. Yes. So solar power. So you know, ever since its genesis, the Earth has been solar powered, and we often sort of neglect that. All of the energy on Earth results essentially from the sun. Or processes associated with the sun. So really the planet, you know, has been solar powered since its birth. But in the past, you know, I don't know, a couple of hundred years, humanity has built a reliance on fossil fuels, you know, with the discovery of oil and et cetera, and we have utilized that as our primary power source. And now, obviously, again, as I often say, that's a finite resource. We can't rely on it. We've got to have a new form of energy, a new source of energy.
Yeah.
And so we come back to the good old sun, because that's the way that it's going to work. You know, forget your nuclear, forget your... you know, whatever other source of your wind power, you know, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Solar is going to be the big one. It really is.
Yeah, well, you can't, it's not going to run out. No,
exactly,
easily.
It's not exactly a finite resource. Mm-hmm. So what we need to do is we need to be able to use it efficiently.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have our solar panels and stuff like that, and that's great. They at best are about 15% efficient, okay, based on silicon solar panels. And not only do you need your solar panels, you also need your batteries, okay? So you need two different technologies there in order to utilize solar power currently, okay? You need your solar panel technology, which is ever improving. You know, people are busy studying that. And you've got your battery technology as well, okay, which also is ever improving, but the two are separate things. So wouldn't it be really nice if you just had the one thing where you could actually... trap solar energy directly and release it when you want it.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, you want it to be as efficient as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a bunch of chemists all around the world who are busy desperately trying to do this. And so published this week published this week in the journal Science, there's some chemists at University of California, Santa Barbara. And they have made a big advance in utilizing or storing solar energy and being able to release it essentially at will, okay? Which you can imagine, that's going to be good. That's going to be a really, really
Cool thing. They found a new way to store it, like to increase the efficiency of how much you're using when it. How does that work?
Okay, now in order to truly understand this, you're going to have to sort of understand a little bit of chemistry.
Oh, yes, please explain.
And I know you just love that.
Yes.
So all matter interacts with light somehow, okay? And what happens is it generally absorbs light. It absorbs certain colors of light, if you want to call it that. And when it does that, what happens within the substance that's absorbing the light, it sort of rejigs the electrons in that, and it what we call excites them,
okay
in other words, it makes them more energetic.
Yeah.
And when they're more energetic, they don't like being more energetic. They want to get rid of that excess energy that they've just picked up from the light, okay? And normally they do that really, really quickly, okay? So what happens is that you get an absorption of say, solar photons from the sun. Your material absorbs that.
Mm-hmm.
The molecules are all now really excited. They're jumping around, excited state, and they don't want to be there, so they get rid of that excess energy, and they can get rid of it as heat, they can get rid of it as light, they can emit colors, etc., etc., etc. But that's the sort of the fundamental process that goes on, okay?
Yeah, okay.
Absorption and very quick re-emission. Now, these guys have discovered this molecule that when it absorbs ultraviolet photons from the sun, okay, and the UVA, the UVB, you've heard about sort of the UVA and UVB, that's the bit that burns you when you go out and, you know, that's the very, very high energy stuff.
Yeah.
So this particular molecule or the series of molecules that they've discovered, what happens is it absorbs ultraviolet light and it basically turns the molecule into a high energy form. But the beauty is that high energy form is stable,
mm-hmm.
or what we call metastable anyway, okay? And so what it does, it absorbs the light, it goes to a high energy state,
yeah,
and then it stays there.
It's not like in a rush to get out of that
exactly,
state.
Exactly. Okay. And that's the trick here. So now we've got this very, very energetic molecule that we've made by absorbing solar photons.
Mm-hmm.
It's really energetic, but it's stable. And it's stable until we either heat it up or treat it with a little bit of acid. And when you do that, it then emits all of that energy as heat.
Okay. Yeah.
So that is seriously, seriously cool stuff. That all you've got to do is put this stuff out in the sun. You know, essentially, there's a little bit more to it than that.
Yeah,
but you basically put it out in the sunlight. It absorbs the ultraviolet radiation in the sunlight. It turns into a high energy version of itself, and then it stays there. And it sits there for as long as you want it.
Yeah.
And whenever you need it, now you can induce it giving out that excess energy simply by, as I say, heating it up or treating it with a little bit of acid.
Yeah, and it will come out as heat. Is that as useful? Like, is that what it normally does when you use solar panels?
Not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily.
Useful, though?
When you're using solar panels, you're more about electricity.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
You're more about electricity generation. Here you're talking about heat, usable heat. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, what they're able to do with this stuff, and this is so cool, that they can boil water with this stuff. Now, it takes a lot of energy to boil water. And they could get, I think it was about 1/2 mil of water boiling in 1 second.
Oh,
okay, just go, wow. Zero, you know, hey, 25 cool. to 100, bam, just like that. So this stuff is
awesome.
Very, very, very energetic.
Yeah.
It's really, really cool. The molecule itself is related to DNA, the bit of the molecule that's doing this energy absorption, it's related to a part of DNA, which is kind of cool. It's a base, for those of you who know about DNA. It's the base part of DNA.
Yeah.
And this is absolutely fascinating. So they've done some measurements in terms of the energy that it can store. It's got about double the energy density of a lithium-ion battery.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're talking something that's potentially extraordinarily useful here.
Yeah.
Very, very, very
well,
cool.
That, and hopefully that'll be applicable for a wider, like on the mainstream, it will be able to be used, like, to capture solar energy.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this is obviously early days, but this sounds really, really exciting. The principle has been known for many years. But the problem has been up until now that the energy of the light that you need to do this has been too great,
mm-hmm.
okay? And all of that gets absorbed by the Earth's atmosphere. It doesn't get through the Earth's atmosphere, this very, very, very high energy ultraviolet light. But now they've got this molecule that doesn't need such energetic ultraviolet light, so it can use light from the sun that does get through the atmosphere. And, oh, man, you know, I can see this going places.
Nice.
It sounds absolutely absolutely brilliant. So
just a classic watch this space.
Of our stories.
Gotta have
science.
One of those.
See, science never ends, folks.
Science never ends. Great. Well, our next topic, speaking of science never ending, this one's about the periodic elements table.
Yes.
I mean, I was trying to work out how many years it's been, because this is the anniversary of when he just scribbled it down, it sounds like.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. What a legendary guy.
So this is 157 years.
157 years since he discovered, so to say, the periodic table.
Yeah.
Which is Amazing. Yeah, that's very cool. You want to talk about that?
And that was today in 1869, the 17th of February. And so a guy by the name of Dmitry Mendeleev, Russian guy, he was meant to go and visit a factory that day. He was, as I say, he was a chemist, so a practicing chemist and everything like that, working at the university and, you know, doing his studies and blah, 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 blah. Sure. All that good stuff. And as part of his job, he was off to visit this factory, but he thought, nah, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to try and figure out how to arrange the known elements in some sort of order.
That's what I usually do when I don't go out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So try and change the world. Yeah.
Try and work out how they're all like arrange them in atomic weight. That's my go-to activity as well. So
all obviously. Of the known elements, in 1869 were certainly not all of the elements that now exist for us. Okay. So you had your hydrogen and helium and lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen.
Oh yeah. I know the song.
All that. So we knew all of those, but you know some things like, for example, germanium was not known at that stage, and there were a few elements that weren't known. But he made the intellectual leap of arranging these elements according to their atomic weight. Okay, and basically, to put it, you know, long story short. Hydrogen's the lightest element, helium is heavier, lithium's heavier than that, and beryllium's heavier than that, and blah, 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 blah. And so they'd got to the stage where they could measure these weights. Now, before that, you know, they really couldn't do that, but they'd come across this concept of atomic weight. They had now the apparatus to be able to measure that. And he was using all of the data that was known at the time, or that were known at the time. Sorry, data is plural.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always forget that.
To order now the elements in terms of their atomic weights. And when he did that, he found something really quite cool, that you got repetition of properties every so often, that you get elements that behave very, very, very similar to each other if you order them in this particular order. So, for example, we've got three metals. You've got lithium, you've got sodium, you've got potassium, which I'm sure you've heard of all of those.
Yes. Okay.
And these metals all have the property that if you take the freshly cut metal and you throw it in water, then it's very, very reactive and you'll eventually get flames and stuff if you use potassium stuff. So they all have very, very similar chemical properties. And he found that when he ordered them in a particular order according to the atomic weight, that these guys all lay in the same column. He actually had it the other way around. He used rows, but now we're more used to it in terms of columns.
Oh, yeah, right, okay.
And basically the guts of it was that the periodic table, you would order all of the elements that behave similarly in separate columns, okay? And that was essentially the basis of what he did. And you might think, well, that's no great shakes. He was just, you know, using the data which were there, and he was just, you know, ordering them according to those data. But his real intellectual leap that he made was he knew that there were holes in his table, that there were holes in his table where there should have been an element, but there wasn't.
So they knew what they were looking for.
So he knew that there must be a missing element there, that there must be something that had yet to be discovered. And what he could do on the basis of the way that he'd ordered it, he could predict the properties of these things that had not yet been discovered. And that's science.
Yeah.
You know, that's extraordinary science. And within sort of 10 or so years, after having sort of put it out there and saying, oh, you know, go looking for these because I reckon they should be there, that they were discovering elements like germanium and stuff that had not yet been discovered. And they fitted in perfectly in the holes on the periodic table, and they had the properties that Mendeleev predicted that they should have. So great, great, great man. This is, you know, today is a historic, well, aren't all day, but a historic
every
day
is a little
in,
bit historic,
in chemistry.
But this
certainly.
Is especially historic and for
and
a
in
very
science.
Specific
I mean,
reason.
You know, the periodic table is something that everybody associates with chemistry and science.
Yeah,
and it's a massive achievement of humanity. And, you know, he didn't do it by himself. He was, again, as always is the case, standing on the shoulders of giants, as Newton said. And, you know, absolutely spectacular stuff. The sad thing is he didn't live long enough to win a Nobel Prize for chemistry. So this was 1869. Uh-huh. The Nobel Prizes came out in 1901. He was nominated at least twice from memory, but he died in 1907 before he could be aware. He should have been a shoo-in. He should have been an absolute shoo-in. But sadly not. But there you go, a great man, Mendeleev. And, of course, he gets his own element on the periodic table, as he should, Mendeleevium.
Oh, okay. Did he actually?
He
did. That's sweet.
Of course, he didn't live to see that, unfortunately, but, you know.
Well, it's a legacy.
But it's absolutely appropriate that he's so immortalised. So.
Exactly. Yeah. That's perfect. Well, okay. Yep. Final topic.
And
this one we can introduce with a song.
Oh, yes, please. Oh,
I've got the song. Yes. Wait, okay, let's see if this works. This is... Well, I'll just play a little bit of it. It's Senses Working Overtime.
Yes.
By XTC, which I was surprised that we would have, but we do. This is a cool one. And you sent it and I was like, oh my god, this is so cool. But this is a story about the senses, the human senses.
Absolutely,
it's so
it is.
It's wait, I'll play a little bit of this.
Oh, that's a great song.
What a great song. Oh yeah. Wait, okay. It makes sense. Well, let's explain the story a bit. People can understand why we put this song on. We're just having a music break in the Dear Science episode this week.
Absolutely.
Actually.
So, Aristotle, way back in the day, said that we had five senses. Okay.
Yeah.
And as they say in the song, as XTC say in the song, he can see, hear, smell, touch, taste.
Yes. He reckons he's got five senses working
overtime. He's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 senses working overtime. Yeah. So, this is all about the senses. And, you know, you probably don't sort of think about that. You sort of, that's something that you're taught. You've got five senses, you know, sight, hearing, smell, touch and taste. But is that really the case? And people in Oxford are saying, no, that's not the case really. And they estimate that we've got somewhere between 22 and 33 senses.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of cool.
That's crazy. Like, that's, how is that, how does that work? What are the other senses?
Well, think about it.
How do we
it.
Not so, discover this before?
Well, you know, it's always been there. It's just that people have never sort of recognized it, let's say. But it's the combination of, you know, maybe our common senses, maybe those five sort of common senses, combinations of those are important in our experiences. So odors, for example, they sort of determine, or they certainly affect the way that we perceive things like the silkiness of hair or the thickness of yogurt, believe it or not. Okay, so so odors are all important in that. And so there's a thing called proprioception, which is a great word, okay?
Yeah.
Now, without thinking about it, where's your hand?
On my body.
You know exactly where your limbs are.
Or like, yeah.
Okay?
Okay, sure.
You know where your limbs are without looking at them.
Yeah.
So how do you know that? What is that sense where you know where your limbs are without looking at them?
Well, it's
not seeing, hearing, smelling, touching or tasting.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so there's a different sense
like
right there.
An internal sense.
Okay.
Okay, yeah.
Your sense of balance.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good one. Okay.
So that's in your inner ear. So that's a sense that we have that's not one of those five. Okay. A thing called interoception. Okay, we can sense changes in our body, things like heart rate, breathing rate, things like that. But you're sort of doing that sort of, you know, or hunger, you know, how does hunger come about? You know, what's hunger? Again, it's a sense.
Yeah.
And even our senses like taste. Now, taste is not sort of, doesn't necessarily go by itself. It goes, it's a combination of touch and smell as well as taste.
Right.
Okay. So... what they found, and this blows my mind, so the perception of sweet and salt and sour is reduced by white noise. So if you've got white noise in the background, you don't taste sweet and sour and
salt. Is
that
true? No way.
And, well, apparently it is. So if you're in a plane, you've got that background noise.
Yeah.
Okay. Then what you find is that your tomatoes and your tomato juices really taste like wow, because you taste umami. Okay, so you taste umami better when you've got white noise going.
What? That's so random.
So the taste of tomatoes and stuff, anything umami is apparently enhanced in a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And again, so we talk about taste. So, you know, we've got receptors for salt and sweet and sour and bitter and umami on our tongue, okay?
Yeah.
So how the hell do we taste raspberries?
I don't know.
Because raspberries aren't salt, sweet, sour, bitter, or umami. You know, there's some sort of combination.
Gotcha.
So basically what these folk in Oxford are arguing is that, no, we've actually got a lot more senses than just the five that Aristotle said. So it's time we moved on from that, I think, you know, embraced all of these new senses that we have.
Have you ever heard someone say that idea that, like, anything that you look at, you can kind of, you know how it's going to taste? had it even if you've never licked it or something like that. Yeah. That sounds so bad. Please, okay. That's such
that,
a weird thing
that
to
could
say.
Be another one. That could
yeah,
be,
maybe that's
a Sarah sings. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I didn't invent that. No accolades, please. Anyway, that's okay. Thank there you so go. Much. And that's very interesting.
And everyone should go and listen to XTC because they're just extraordinary. Yeah.
Shout out there all go. The senses. But there's like at least 22 or something well, working
22
overtime.
To 33 working.
All
yeah.
of your senses are working overtime.
There we go. One, two, three, four, that's the one. That's the one.
Yeah.
Very good.
Perfect. Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, that's all of the time we have for Dear Science this week. Thank you so much.
All good.
Yeah, we've just been chatting away.
We have.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Alan, for joining us. Thank you, as always, to MoTat. Yeah. And thank you, Science. We're going to be back right after a quick break. Just keep it on the beat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MoTat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.